There are times when I sit through something, constantly asking myself, why are you subjecting yourself to this, yet can't seem to switch away from it. Recently, for instance, when I found a streaming channel I recently discovered screening all 12 episodes of the obscure 1931 movie serial King of the Wild back to back, I actually did switch away to other channels several times, but found myself inexorably drawn back to this crackly soundtrack monochrome oddity. The trouble with such showings of serials in one sitting is that not only do they seem interminable, but that they highlight their repetitiveness and overly convoluted storylines. King of the Wild, for instance, was virtually impossible to follow, so complex did it make its plots and subplots. Yet their execution involved the same scenarios being repeated over and over. In their one episode a week format, of course, they don't feel this way. The odds are that the audience will barely remember what happened in the previous episode, let alone three or four episodes ago. Moreover, a straightforward plot would never be able to sustain 4+ hours of total screen time. As far as I could make out, King of the Wild started with a plot about a white guy having to impersonate a dead Maharaja at the Maharaja's request in order to stop some evil prince from seizing the realm before his own brother, the rightful heir, turned up. Being framed for the Maharaja's murder, jailed, then escaping to Africa, disguised as an Arab now, in search of a letter that would clear his name. Which sounds like a lot of plot. But that's just the first couple of episodes, as our hero then gets involved in a plot involving a girl searching for a lost brother who knows something about some shenanigans involving diamonds, while opposed by a villainous big game hunter who has some kind of ape man as a henchman and a nefarious Arab played by Boris Karloff. Oh, and there's this guy in drag wandering about who's also some kind of villain. All of which might sound exciting, but unfortunately isn't. It drags along at a deathly pace with far too many talky scenes of exposition padding out the episodes, poor production values, and California making a poor stand-in for Africa. The whole thing quickly becomes tediously repetitive, with the cliffhanger seemingly involving the brother being found and lost and captured by a villain again, or his sister being repeatedly kidnapped, imprisoned and otherwise imperiled. So why did I keep going back to it? Well, I can't deny that I have a weakness for these old serials. They could often be surprisingly good, especially those produced by Republic in the late 30s and 40s, which featured excellent special effects courtesy of some sophisticated miniatures work by the Lydecker brothers, and some of the best choreographed fight and action sequences of their era. King of the Wild, however, is a somewhat earlier production produced by Masker, who were later subsumed into Republic, a Poverty Row studio that nonetheless turned out some enjoyable serials. But while King of the Wild certainly had enough bizarre elements, the Ape Man, Boris Karloff and all those characters in disguise, they never really gel into anything compelling that might lift the serial out of the ordinary. Maybe if I had watched an episode at a time on a weekly or even daily basis, it might have felt pacier and less repetitive. I actually did this once, watching all 12 episodes of Republic's The Masked Marvel from 1943 this way, and found it hugely entertaining, only 20 minutes or so a day. Anyway, the long and short of all this is that, despite it exerting a certain dreadful fascination over me, watching King of the Wild or any other serial in a single sitting like this isn't an experience I'm likely to repeat in a hurry. If nothing else, it made me appreciate those feature versions of serials they released to TV in the 60s, cut down to 100 or sometimes even 70 or 75 minutes running time, excising most of the padding and repetition.
Psychopath, psychopath. Six he must slay, crushing the first in a devilish way. Psychopath, psychopath, five is a game of violent death with a scorching flame. Psychopath, psychopath, leaving no clue. What man can guess what next you will do?
Looks like another case of looking for a needle in a haystack, sir.
That dog's our needle.
Psychopath, psychopath, a tortured scream before the knife's descending gleam. Psychopath, psychopath, poisons the game for the man who knows your unknown name. Psychopath, psychopath, still on the loose, bearing the hangman's deadly noose.
And so there was one. Ledoux.
None, sir.
Psychopath, psychopath. Ominous fright. Threats of sticks of dynamite. Days without end of warning so chill. If you don't kill tonight, then tomorrow you will.
A film I hadn't seen in its entirety since a rare late-night screening on British TV back in the late 70s or early 80s. By chance, I caught the end of 1966's The Psychopath on a live streaming channel the other night. The screening used the more than slightly scuzzy-looking German print with the original English dialogue track that has been the source of most versions available via illegal download sites, well-known video sharing sites, and dodgy streaming channels over the past couple of decades. One of Amica's less well-known, these days at least, films, it was made before the company had settled into its regular niche of producing portmanteau horror films, and represented an attempt to imitate their rival Hammer's recent series of psychological horror films, which included films like Maniac and Paranoid, which had all been inspired by Hitchcock's Psycho. Not only does the Amicus film echo that of Psycho, but it was also scripted by Robert Bloch, who had written the source novel for the Hitchcock film. Unfortunately, it never rises to the heights of that film, although, in its own right, it is an entertaining movie. As can be seen from the trailer, The Psychopath is, in truth, more of a murder mystery than a psychodrama, with Patrick Wymark's police inspector investigating a series of bizarre murders where a doll in the victim's image is found with each body. Bloch's script tries for a psycho vibe by making the main suspects a strange and socially maladjusted young man who lives with his quite clearly bad mother, who actually is still alive in this particular scenario. The fact that she has a house full of creepy dolls means that we're never really in any doubt as to the killer's identity, despite a poor attempt at misdirection on Bloch's part, which doesn't last long, involving a millionaire and his displeasure over his daughter's choice of boyfriend. Where the film's strength lies is in its direction by Freddie Francis, who had also directed a number of Hammer films, sub-Hitchcock dramas. Not only are the killings imaginatively staged, but the whole film is stylishly directed, with Francis making effective use of a rather garish colour palette and unusual camera angles to frame his scenes, giving them an off-kilter feel. Indeed, the film somewhat resembles an Italian giallo, even though that genre was barely established in Italy and still not that familiar to British audiences. The resemblance is further emphasised by the fact that, as in most classic giallos, the killings have their roots in some past family trauma. The sparse but effectively atmospheric musical score by Elizabeth Loitjens is also highly reminiscent of the sort of scores employed by many true giallo movies. Perhaps not surprisingly, in view of these parallels, The Psychopath proved very popular on the continent, particularly Germany. It's well worth a look if you can get to see it, and Arrow have released a DVD, did release a DVD a couple of years ago, so it is now available legally. The Psychopath is one of Amica's stronger early movies, despite its derivative nature.
Willard!
This is Willard, and these are his friends, Ben,
And Socrates.
I'm going to have a big surprise tomorrow.
Willard takes good care of them.
What's that in your pocket? There's something in your pocket.
And they will do anything for Willard.
Joy.
Walter. Please, Walter, there's something outside the door.
My God, look at the rats.
You made me hate myself. Well, I like myself now.
You know, my life has changed now. Two things did it. One was a friend I had named Socrates. And you.
Where your nightmares end, Willard begins. Willard is the one movie you should not see alone.
I finally managed to get around to watching a double bill of killer rat movies recently. Not just any killer rat movies, but the killer rat movies. 1971's Willard and its follow-up Ben from 1972. Both films are very much of their era in their depictions of suburban America, with direction that is solid rather than inspired and production values slightly above those of contemporary TV movies. Willard, on its initial release, was pitched less as a horror movie than as a psychological character study with horror elements. Indeed, both films focus on lonely, isolated individuals who, for varying reasons, find it difficult to form relationships with other human beings, instead turning to rats for companionship, and certainly in the case of Willard, a substitute family. The titular Willard, played by Bruce Davison, is a young man caught between a domineering sick mother at home and a bullying boss at work. The situation is complicated by the fact that Willard's father had founded the firm he works at, but, according to his mother, been cheated out of it. Or rather, cheated out of control of it by Willard's boss, Al Martin, played by Ernest Borgnine, with Willard now only being employed there as a condition of the takeover. From early on, it's clear that Willard has no actual friends of his own. Everyone attending his birthday party, for instance, are simply his mother's friends. And he's obviously bullied and isolated at work. He has no life between work and looking after his mother, although he manages to establish a stumbling, tentative friendship with a temp, played by Sondra Locke, brought in to help him in the office. Willard finds solace observing a colony of rats living in the garden his mother wants him to kill, gradually establishing a relationship with them, befriending a white rat he named Socrates. When his mother dies, he moves the rats into the house and continues to train them to obey his commands. Socrates is joined by a black rat, Ben, as a leader of the pack, and Willard starts to use him to disrupt a party at his boss's house and rob a client to obtain the money he needs to pay some back taxes and thereby avoid the house being foreclosed upon. During all of this, Willard increasingly isolates himself from his mother's friends and acquaintances, and indeed his own workmates, with the exception of Sondra Locke. Taking Socrates and Ben secretly into the office with him ends in disaster when Socrates is seen and killed by Martin. Willard reacts by confronting Martin at the office out of hours and setting Ben and the other rats on him. With Martin and his best friend Socrates dead, Willard sees the opportunity for a new life, abandoning Ben and drowning the rats remaining at his house. He hopes to embark on a relationship with a girl from the office, his confidence having been boosted by having proven to himself that he could develop relationships outside his mother's circle through his befriending Socrates and the other rats. A vengeful Ben, however, turns up with the other rats from the attack on Martin and set upon Willard at his house. Now, Willard turned out to be successful enough to warrant an immediate sequel. Despite a lack of gore and featuring only two fatal rat attacks, Willard appealed primarily to horror film audiences, so naturally any sequel was inevitably going to ramp up these elements. At the same time, the producers were obviously keenly aware that the relationship between the rats and the main protagonist were a key factor in the film's success. The idea of an undertrodden and bullied individual gaining revenge upon his tormentors and oppressors via not a supernatural, but quite natural force in the form of a rat pack had undoubted appeal, feeding into the latent revenge and power fantasies of many of the audience members. The problem with Willard, though, was that the title character was not in himself hugely sympathetic, a weak and indecisive character who, although a grown man, frequently acts like a child. The obvious answer was to make the main character of the sequel an actual child, one isolated not by bullying or a dysfunctional family, but illness. It also helped the new film over another hurdle, that the surviving main rat character, Ben, was the least likeable of the rats portrayed of being jealous of Willard's relationship with Socrates, and also being the most aggressive and vicious of the pack. By having him befriend a sick kid, he instantly becomes more sympathetic. Another crucial difference between the two films is that the boy himself never actually directs the rats to do anything. Led by Ben, they are now autonomously raiding supermarkets and chocolate factories in their quest for food, attacking anyone who tries to stop them or threatens the pack. Now, Ben truly is a direct sequel to Willard, quite literally picking up where that film left off. The scenes of Willard's demise are replayed under the opening titles. After this, the action switches to the scene outside, with a police cordon holding off gathered onlookers, including the sick kid, his older sister and mother, back from the scene. Two plots, the budding bromance between the lonely boy and Ben, and the police's attempts to track down Ben and locate the rat's nest, then develop in parallel, coming together at the climax as the boy tries to warn Ben of the impending police attack on the sewers where the pack is hiding out. The climactic police assault on the sewers includes some brutal images of rats being vigorously shot, burned with flamethrowers, and drowned. These scenes, along with the numerous fatal rat attacks throughout the film, puts Ben more firmly in the horror genre than its predecessor. Despite the climactic carnage, the final scene shows injured Ben making his way back to the boy, who starts tending to his wounds, at which point, with everything set up for another sequel, the sickly saccharine sounds of Michael Jackson's theme song cuts in. Although successful, there were no further sequels, which is undoubtedly a good thing, as the two films had just about covered all the angles you could get from the scenario. It has to be said that while entertaining, Ben is still an inferior film to Willard. For one thing, it suffers from the absence of performers like Bruce Davison, Ernest Borgnine, Elsa Lanchester and Sondra Locke, all of whom had put in excellent performances in the first film. Well, in the sequel, Lee Montgomery Harcourt is fine as the boy, and Meredith Baxter does her best in the underdeveloped role of her sister. Of the supporting cast, only Joseph Campanella, playing yet another harassed cop, really stands out. Perhaps the biggest weakness of the sequel is the way in which the relationship between the boy and Ben is portrayed. It's far too cloying and sentimental, lacking the sinister edge of Willard's relationship with his rat friends. In the final analysis, both films remain enjoyable, and I well remember the impact they had on the release in the early 70s. I was far too young to see them then, obviously, and some I missed their TV outings. The focus on rats, an animal omnipresent in modern human civilization as their monster, at a time when werewolves and vampires still abounded in horror films, along with the contemporary settings, made them feel not just plausible, but also made them somewhat groundbreaking. Arguably, their success helped pave the way for the many eco-horror and revenge of nature movies that followed during the 70s.
Where Willard ended, Ben begins. Ben is coming from Cinerama Releasing, and this time, he's not alone.
Maybe he was Ben.
That's the name of the leader of the rats.
There were some pages from Willard's diary in the newspapers.
Rats killed three people.
All residents, go in and stay in your houses.
Drive the rats in the tank area.
They're eating us alive down there. There's millions of them.
And they're coming for you. They're coming. They're gonna burn you, Ben. And then they're gonna drown you. Run, Ben. Run, please.
Ben and his army of rats are on the way.
Of course, one of the other miracles of modern streaming TV, apart from being able to watch old US sitcoms, of course, is that films that once turned up rarely on terrestrial TV back in the day now seem to be playing constantly. The spaghetti western My Name is Nobody from 1973, which features the bizarre once-in-a-lifetime star pairing of Henry Fonda and Terence Hill, I had, until a couple of years ago, seen only once in an early 90s screening on BBC Two. Then, during the first lockdown, it turned up on an on-demand service that I have, and I caught it again. Now, thanks to a live streaming service I get on Roku, I've seen it three times in as many weeks. Despite the repetition, I do still enjoy it. I mean, with that cast, you know, who wouldn't? Another spaghetti western that only used to make rare appearances on terrestrial TV was 1971's Pancho Villa. I say spaghetti western, but while it was filmed in Spain, like many true spaghetti westerns, it was actually a Spanish-UK-US co-production with no Italian participation. Anyway, it now seems to play constantly across a live streaming multi-channel Roku app I have installed. I actually watched it all the way through the other day, and you know what? It actually wasn't that bad. Okay, it is a completely fictionalized a hugely unhistorical account of the famed Mexican bandit-turned-revolutionary general's 1916 incursion into the US, when he and some of his bandits, stroke revolutionaries, attacked Columbus, New Mexico. But it is entertainingly done and played largely as farce. Even if it does continue an obsession on the part of filmmakers in casting bald actors, Telly Savalas in this instance, as the historically hairy Villa. See also 1968's Villa Rise with Yul Brynner in this respect. But one of the most interesting things about the film is its use of some truly wonderful large-scale model trains in several action sequences. Now, these trains also turned up in the following year's Horror Express, which also used the coach interiors redressed from Pancho Villa, which was produced by the same team. The story did the rounds at the time of Horror Express release, and persists to this day, was that the producer of both films had bought the trains from the producers of Nicholas and Alexander, made in 1971, and built both films around them. A variation on the story has it they were originally built for Dr. Zhivago, which of course appeared in 1965. However, producer Bernard Gordon has denied this, claiming that the models were specially built for Pancho Villa. Indeed, the fact that locomotives and rolling stock appear to conform to Spanish designs in order to match up to the real locomotives and rolling stock seen in other scenes, this claim seems to have credence, both Nicholas and Alexander and Dr. Zhivago being set in Tsarist Russia, dictating that their train models would probably be appropriate to this setting. Nevertheless, I still have my suspicions that, even on Pancho Villa, the models were second-hand. Another film set during the Mexican Revolution had also been shot in Spain in 1970-71. Sergio Leone's Fistful of Dynamite, which was released in 1971 and is also sometimes to be seen under the original US release title of Duck, You Sucker. At its climax, this film, like Pancho Villa, features a spectacular and magnificently staged head-on train crash using large-scale model trains. Now, from memory, the model trains used were certainly similar to those used in Pancho Villa, following Spanish outlines so as to match up with the real trains used in other sequences once again. So did Pancho Villa and Horror Express use model trains recycled from Fistful of Dynamite? Possibly. It isn't unusual for props to be recycled between films, sets and scenery as well, in order to reduce costs. Certainly the models used in all of these films must have been built to a very large scale. In Pancho Villa, their sequences are shot outside rather than in a studio and have a level of detail that makes them appear very realistic, which implies that they were very expensive to originally build. Too expensive, perhaps, for a modestly budgeted production like Pancho Villa to have built them up from scratch? I don't know. Whatever the truth, they are pretty magnificent looking and surprisingly convincing. Far better than the HO or O scale model trains, usually commercially available products, that turn up in many other low budget movies. See, for instance, the train sequence in 1957's The Black Scorpion, where the manufacturer's name, Lionel Trains, can clearly be seen on the side of the locomotive's tender, which is coupled to the locomotive the wrong way round, for what it's worth. They alone, these trains alone, make Pancho Villa worth watching. That and the fact that Telly Savalas sings the song over the closing credits. No, it really shouldn't be allowed, should it?
Never before so much paralyzing terror as in this hair-raising orgy of sadism, influenced by the shocking writings of the evil, depraved Marquis de Sade. Bloody Pit of Horror. Starring Mickey Hargitay as the Crimson Executioner. They come to photograph seductive models against a medieval background and find themselves helplessly trapped in a castle of horrors.
Susie! What?
The mercy of the twisted perversions of a madman who satisfies his lust by torturing his victims with the bone-breaking rack, the razor-sharp swords, the scalding, boiling oil, the deadly spider web. These and other fiendish torments make Bloody Pit of Horror one of the most terrifying films ever made.
Public domain favourite for streaming channels, 1965's Bloody Pit of Horror was one of a wave of horror movies, usually of continental origin, that traded on the idea that they were somehow inspired by the works of the Marquis de Sade. In practice, this meant presenting scenarios whereby a bevy of young actresses clad only in their underwear find themselves strapped to various medieval torture devices and, well, tortured. Being the 60s, there was, of course, no nudity and certainly none of the gore effects that would become par for the course in the 70s, particularly in Italian films. Bloody Pit of Horror, an Italian production, falls into that subset of such Sadean films, whose scenario involved groups of models finding themselves trapped in old castles for photo shoots and subsequently find themselves menaced by some torture-obsessed loony who lurks around the place. Said loonies are frequently the descendants of notorious torturers who now believe that they are possessed by their infamous ancestor. In the case of Bloody Pit of Horror, a group of models, photographers and a writer have the misfortune to pitch up at a castle owned by Mickey Hargitay, who, offended by all the lewdness involved in the photo shoot, dons the mantle of the castle's former owner, the Crimson Executioner, in order to dispatch them all in unpleasant and painful ways. His dungeon includes all the usual racks, iron maidens and the like, and people are variously impaled, covered in hot oil and burned to death down there. Some of the tortures, though, the business with the spider's web and the very crap spider, for instance, are less novel and terrifying, than simply ludicrous and unintentionally hilarious. The plot quickly degenerates into lots of running around castle corridors and secret passages before building to an energetic climax in the dungeon, which sees a frenzied Hargate running from torture device to torture device, gleefully ensuring that each victim is experiencing the maximum pain. Indeed, Hargate's bravura performance as the utterly bonkers Crimson Executioner is a highlight of the film. Director Domenico Massimo Pupillo moves all along at a reasonable pace so that the film never quite outstays its welcome. Not a classic by any stretch of the imagination. Bloody Pit of Horror is nonetheless very entertaining if you catch it in the right mood, although devoted sadists are likely to be left feeling disappointed. And in common with many continental horror movies, Bloody Pit of Horror exists in several English language versions with varying running times. So depending on which version you get to see, content may vary slightly.
There are mysteries in the world of which we know little. Strange, frightening, whispered from generation to generation until they become a scream out of the past. Woman of flesh becomes a mistress of the Death Master, sharing his hunger for souls, his thirst for human blood.
Enjoyed your little joke last night, Doctor. But as you can see, tonight is mine.
Incredible. You really are a vampire?
Yes.
The flesh that shapes them, the blood that feeds them, once belonged to others. Driven by the forbidden cravings of another world, they band together as his slaves. It happened to them.
It could happen to you.
When first released, these two films were seen as breaking new territory for the traditional vampire, by placing him in the present day rather than in a period setting as Hammer's Gothic horrors had done. Of course, it wasn't strictly true to say that there hadn't been previous contemporary set vampire movies before the Count Yorga films. Let's not forget that Universal's Dracula back in 1930 had placed Bela Lugosi's Count firmly in the then present day, while Columbia's Return of the Vampire from 1943, also starring Lugosi, had its vampire twitching his cloak through wartime London. Other attempts at contemporary vampires included The Return of Dracula in 1958, which attempted to put Francis Lederer's Count into a contemporary small-town US setting, and 1957's The Vampire, which had a similar small-town setting but added a science fiction twist to its story. By the time the Count Yorga movies were released, however, Hammer's version of The Vampire, always portrayed in Victorian or Edwardian settings, it dominated screens for over a decade, so the AIP films seemed fresh and novel in their approach. Certainly, they were influential enough to persuade Hammer to put Dracula into contemporary London for its next two films in their series, Dracula AD 1972, released in, not surprisingly, 1972, and The Satanic Rites of Dracula from 1973, also known as Count Dracula and His Vampire Bride, if you saw it in the States. These both had mixed success. Hammer never quite solved the problem of properly integrating such an archaic figure into the modern day. Interestingly, re-watching the two Count Yorga films recently, it is clear that their makers found themselves running up against the same problems, that a man in a cloak wandering around 70s California is a more than slightly ridiculous sight. The first film, Count Yorga Vampire from 1971, actually starts well in this respect, with Robert Quarry's Count Yorga posing as a medium and running seances for trendy middle-class Californian professionals. In this guise, he fits surprisingly well into the whole late 60s, early 70s West Coast mysticism scene. Thereafter, though, his presence is confined largely to his mock Gothic pile in the country, which might just as well be located in 19th century Middle Europe as it is in 70s California. Yeah, the characters spend plenty of time interacting in 70s San Francisco, but that's already their world. We see nothing of Yorga trying to negotiate the modern world. Ultimately, the film's latter stages resolve into Vera's characters chasing around a Gothic castle, much like any traditional vampire film. The approach taken here is remarkably similar to that taken by Hammer in Dracula AD 1972, where Christopher Lee's present-day appearances are pretty much confined to a deconsecrated ruined Gothic church, with any depravities in 1972 Chelsea instead being carried out by his swinging acolytes. Eventually, the forces of good, led by Van Helsing's grandson, played by Peter Cushing, who also played Van Helsing, are forced to confront Dracula on his own ground in the church, just as Yorga's opponents were forced to meet him on his ground in his castle. 1972's The Return of Count Yorga is an altogether better film than its predecessor. A bigger budget and more polished production values, combined with a more inventive script, although the problem of integrating an aristocratic Gothic monster into a contemporary setting still isn't properly resolved. The problem of Yorga's traditional vampire getup is initially addressed by having him first encounter the film's protagonist at a fancy dress Halloween party, where his Bela Lugosi chic barely raises an eyebrow. "Where are your fangs?" asks one guest, drawing the retort, "and where are your manners?" But once again, Count Yorga spends the better part of the film lurking around a Gothic mansion where, once again, various of the protagonists end up chasing around the gloomy corridors and cellars of the film's climax. This time, though, the Count does make a few forays out into the modern world in search of victims. Unfortunately, these prove to be among the film's weaker sequences. The sight of Yorga, cape flapping behind him, as he charges down a landing pier at a marina toward a yacht whose occupancy he is targeting, for instance, is more than mildly ludicrous. By contrast, one of the film's most effective sequences comes when, like Dracula in Dracula AD 1972, he sends his acolytes in the form of his vampire bride's act to do his bidding. Perhaps in a reflection of changing tastes on the part of horror audiences, the brides, in their brutal home invasion, behave more like zombies from Romero's Night of the Living Dead than traditional vampires. Hammer's second stab at the modern-day Dracula, perhaps coincidentally, follows a similar format to The Return of Count Yorga. Aside from a sequence in a modern office building, where he masquerades as a reclusive businessman D.D. Denham, Satanic Rites of Dracula sees Lee's Count performing much of the film in full vampire regalia, lurking around an isolated mansion. Dracula also has a coterie of vampiric brides down in the cellar, but doesn't send them out to commit depravities on his behalf. Instead, he sends out a bunch of zombie-like motorcycle-riding acolytes, who also vaguely resemble Manson-type cultists in their dress. Like the second Yorga film, overall, The Satanic Rites of Dracula feels a more polished production than its predecessor, yet still never really tackles that central problem of how to integrate the Gothic vampire convincingly into the modern era. While the Count Yorga films, seen today, might not be quite as groundbreaking or successful in achieving this task as their supporters would have you believe, they remain tremendously enjoyable films, benefiting greatly from Robert Quarry's central performances as Count Yorga, switching with ease between suave sophistication and blood-fueled savagery, not to mention Bob Keljan's effective direction, which makes the most of his resources and locations. Overall, one has to say that, while they never really do quite resolve the problem of bringing the vampire into the present, they still do it somewhat better than the two Hammer efforts. Although, to be fair, neither of the contemporary Dracula films are as bad as many critics have made them out to be over the years.
Who knows the evil force that rules the night? Who calls forth those terrors from beyond the grave to prowl its shadows? Where is the overlord of the damned? Beware is coming. Beware the return of the Death Master. The attack of the undead. I can destroy you. I'll turn you into the living dead. I'll let you go. The most horrifying love story ever filmed.
When she discovers what you are, she'll sicken at your name. Kill her. Kill her.